money for carpet and drapes. And, mm-hmm. But it turned out that job was full when I went to apply for it. And so the person sent me over to the foundation and said, well, you might want this job. I know somebody that's looking for a job. And they were looking for a grant and contract administrator, somebody that kind of did the money and followed the regulations mm-hmm. and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so I met Bill Erickson, who was in charge of the foundation at that time. And then he had me interview another man who was going to hire the position. And the other man interviewed me, but he had a friend who also he interviewed, and he hired the friend, which was fine, very nice lady. But before they told me that I didn't have that job, I got a call from a professor in the College of Education, and he was the quarter-time head of the foundation's International Project Center. Mm-hmm. And so he called, and he's very direct. He says, well, I hear you're looking for a job, and he said, and I've got this job, and my wife says that she thinks she would do it. And I had met his wife working on registration, very nice lady. And mm-hmm. So this was Bob Nardelli, my first boss at the foundation, a faculty member. But in the phone call, he says, well, I hear you have five little kids. Do you really think you can do the job? I was a little taken aback. I said yes.
Good for you.
So, and I can remember driving to work the first day and in the freeway and thinking, what am I doing?
How far was it from your home
campus? About 20 minutes drive. I lived in El Cajon and to campus. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to give this 2 years. If I'm going to, you know, do something, I'll do it for 2 years. And we'll have the carpet and drapes, and then I'll figure something out. But it worked out really well. He was a good boss. And I think the fact that, I don't know, it's now 1969.
69 is when you started. Yeah, I remember reading that. Yeah.
So.
Okay, so, and you have five children. Wow.
They're all good. Four girls, a boy in the middle.
That's wonderful.
They're Kathy, Terry, Steve, Lori, and Debbie.
That's terrific.
So I'm lucky.
Yeah, that's really marvelous. And so this is the 60s, though, and as we know, the 60s was a time of a lot of changes on campuses. Mm-hmm. And tell me about this international program. It sounds like it's something, as I saw some of the material, it's also the time, like, beginning the Peace Corps and all of these kinds of the thinking, the Kennedy years were before, and then Johnson. And so what was it about, that job?
Well, it was managing a lot of Peace Corps contracts. So we had Peace Corps training. It was actually Peace Corps training. So we had Peace Corps training in Jamaica, and then later in other areas of the Caribbean. And we had Agency for International Development, big program. These were million-dollar programs,
right.
And they were in Jamaica to start, and then Brazil. And so we also had some smaller Department of Education, International Educators Program. So there were professionals coming from other countries to San Diego to get trained, and then starting with Peace Corps, which was, and then what our job was to, you know, hire the people to run the programs and do all the logistics and buy the books and just arrange for the hotels. We had in-country training, too, for a month each summer for the first 4 years. So here I was, hired in February, end of February, And the first program was a summer program in Jamaica with 120 volunteers. I loved the volunteers. They were great. And with 50 Jamaican staff members. And they all came up and worked in Southeast San Diego, and this was when there was a shooting or some shootings in Southeast San Diego, and but we had moved our offices, so I was sharing an office with the principal at Stockton School, and my kids were always involved in these international programs, so my son would come down and play baseball with the little kids down there on the weekend, because I'd work on weekends sometimes, and the girls would come down and help with this old-fashioned ditto machine.
That's wonderful.
So, but what happened that first year was the woman who came from Washington, who was supposed to go to Jamaica with the Peace Corps volunteers, got sick, and my boss said, "Freya, can you kind of learn what her job is and do it?" And then he wanted me to go to Jamaica, and I really, at the time, I wasn't much of a traveler. Although I'll take that back, my family always took us to Washington, D.C. about 3 times a year to go to visit relatives. So, but it was a little scary, the thought of going, so I said, I don't. My husband was already worried about me going to Southeast San Diego. And so when I came home and I said, "A really funny thing happened today. You know, my boss asked me to go to Jamaica for a month." And you know, bless his heart, he's a good man. And he said, "Honey, you'll never get a chance like this again. So you go and we will... You know, and the kids at the time were ages 3 to 10.
Right.
And I said, "You go." So I'm, you know, a little bit trembling about the thought, but I went. And
it's marvelous.
Of course, from then on, the next 4 summers, I was
it's great.
Doing Peace Corps training again. So, and some great experiences of just working with the Jamaican staff and working with the Peace Corps volunteers were just great. Like, I can remember visiting a little town in Jamaica where the volunteer was working. It was called Wait a Bit. And the family had made us this really nice chicken dinner. And they dressed up, and the little boy had aqua-colored rubber boots to dress up.
Nice.
So there were a lot of nice experiences with the Peace Corps training programs.
It was a very special time. I mean, there was that whole spirit in the 60s after Kennedy, and people really felt they could make a difference.
And they learned, the volunteers benefited. You know, it wasn't just them benefiting the country. They benefited, and it was a really, really nice time. It was when the Peace Corps had just started accepting older couples or older people. So somebody who had retired from welding or something, would get involved. And so we had some older couples in there.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful beginning in terms of your beginning work in the San Diego State University Research Foundation. In addition to doing your job, were you also learning about the foundation and what else it did at that time, or were you pretty much just focused on what you were doing at the time? It sounds like you had a lot on your plate with the children and everything else, but
I was pretty much focused,
I would think,
on what I was doing, and especially the big Brazilian Agency for International Development program. And again, I went down there for a month and set up an office in Brasilia.
Did that happen in the 70s?
That program had started in the 60s before I actually came, but they moved their office from Rio to Brasilia.
Because I believe I'm recollecting when I interviewed Dr. Brage Golding talking about going to Brazil.
He did, and I was going to say, although I wasn't very involved in what I knew, the foundation basically, when the faculty got a grant, that the foundation would handle the money, and that was a job that I didn't get, which I was so glad afterwards.
Yeah,
but it's an important job though, very. But Brage Golding, the way I did know what was happening on campus was when we had all these events that I would have to kind of do the logistics for. Brage Golding and the other officials, campus officials, would always attend, and they were very supportive. And in fact, when Brage first got his job, he would never remember this, but I do, because I was over on the at the campus commons and having lunch, and this man walked up to me and said, I saw your picture in Brazil. And apparently they had had my office in the office in Brazil, they'd had my picture. So I thought, well, that was really friendly of the new president to do
That's very nice.
So that was nice. And he had always been supportive. So, but I, as far as the various things that the foundation was doing, it was pretty much really doing just the business part of the grants at mm-hmm. that time. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a wonderful entry point, though. Let's do that. So okay. I'll say something to you about... I'd like you to tell me about the genesis of the San Diego State University Research Foundation a little bit, and then about its mission, and then within that context, please describe, as you went on from your initial job, the next jobs and how it all worked.
I'd love to. Okay. Well, the foundation was formed in 1943, a long time ago. It actually, I think, first started getting a few little grants in the 1960s. It's an auxiliary organization within the California State's university system, and its mission really is to serve the university, to serve San Diego State University. It's a nonprofit 501c3 corporation, and the foundation has been able to serve the university in ways that really supplement and enhance what the university is able to do. And so the traditional activities at the beginning were mainly manage some grants, some small grants. In the early 60s, they started getting some Peace Corps training programs, and so then they started managing more grants. It was very small. I understand there were maybe three people in the office to begin with, and before I came.
Yeah.
And but in the early 60s, when they got some Peace Corps training grants, and then in the 60s, they had the university got its first joint doctoral program in chemistry, and that led to more grants. When I got there in 69 for the International Project Center, I remember there were about maybe $6 million of grants, but of that, about $3 million, or between $2 and $3 million, were grants from the International Project Center. So they weren't the faculty research grants. However, as the joint doctoral program started, that led to more faculty. Mm-hmm. And I think my dad had mentioned that it became more important to publish.
Absolutely.
And so when that started, then of course there ended up being more grants. I can remember, I guess what I should do is just say that some of the purposes. So to begin with, it was managing grants. Mm-hmm. Then I think they bought some property for the university, just a little bit of property. Mm-hmm. There ended up being some fee-for-service special programs where faculty would do workshops, or they'd be given a little money, and so any kind of extra money that came into the university, mm-hmm. then the foundation would manage that money. And so they handled those special programs. As by 1975, mm-hmm. I ended up being invited to become a full-time staff member of the foundation. Before, I was partly soft money and a little bit foundation mm-hmm. money. And so at that point, I established the proposal development office, and where we provided a lot more help. Mm-hmm. Faculty in the sciences generally know who's going to fund them, but there were faculty all over the campus in different disciplines that we started finding about. I was able to borrow the part-time of the secretary of the general manager, and I started publishing a newsletter and finding grant opportunities and going to Washington and
that's terrific.
You know, checking with people. And
that's
so
terrific, because I am aware, and I think that I really noticed this, that beginning with Brage Golding, he was a scientist, and then
yes.
Thomas Day was a scientist, and so much happened in the scientific realm that it sounds very marvelous that there was something else going on.
Yeah, and that was really has contributed to the university's research growth. Brage Golding brought in Jim Cobble from I think Notre Dame. Well, not Notre Dame. But he did bring in Jim Cobble, a chemist, a scientist, and Jim became graduate dean and
right.
later on vice president. But Brage had named Jim Cobble to be the vice president of the foundation, and I think Jim's huge contribution was putting together all the joint doctoral programs. I think there were 15 or so when he left. And all of those have contributed a lot to the research reputation of the
right.
university. So Brage brought Jim. And so back to what the foundation does, mm-hmm. as that happened, as we added the function of helping faculty to get grants and, you know, speaking on for them in Washington sometimes, depending. Again, the scientists could take care of their, mm-hmm. they had their own connections, but we found a lot of opportunities, and we also were able to develop some big major programs ourselves where an individual faculty member wouldn't necessarily do it, but we could bring together faculty members and people from other organizations around the country and in some cases around the world and put together some major programs and help
with
us. So it was, that was really an exciting thing. And this is backtracking a little bit, but one of the things about me is I always loved matchmaking. And so when I was a little girl, when we visited my family and my relatives in Washington, D.C., I had made friends with a little 8-year-old. I was 6, and I made friends with a little 8-year-old girl, and then I made friends with another little 8-year-old girl, and they didn't know each other. And so I put them together,
yeah.
and they loved each other, and they went off and left the 6-year-old alone. But
oh,
I had this really nice feeling that I had put them together.
That's very nice.
So when I was offered this job to do the proposal development, start that function, I thought,
that's
wonderful,
great.
I can do this matchmaking, you know, and to get paid to do it.
That's lovely.
So that was fun.
That's a great skill,
to
see what could work together.
It doesn't always work, but a lot of times it does. But the foundation also, as the programs grew, and we, like the first year that development office started, mm-hmm. We went from kind of what had been a steady state around $6 million in grants and contracts to $10 million. So it really worked to put that extra support into that function, but then we needed to have more space. There wasn't space on campus for these projects. So the foundation in a fairly big way got into buying up properties that the projects could be housed in. And so and in fact, let's see, I had mentioned Bill Erickson as
yes.
being in charge of the foundation, and he When I was first there, there were maybe enough people to fit in one room. And he called us all into one room for a meeting. He was great. And he just always, his thing was to remind us that we're here to serve the university and always keep that in mind. So that mm-hmm. kind of was imprinted on my mind. And I always felt that way. After he left, Bob Benshoff, who had been our finance CFO, was general manager for a little bit, and then he appointed me to be associate general manager. He and Davian Gibson, who's a big part of the foundation, was the special assistant and later an associate general manager, one of several. And they were the ones who decided first that there'd be a proposal development function, and then Bob decided that I should be the associate general manager. And so that was a very nice thing. And then when Bob decided he'd rather do the financial thing and not be the manager, mm-hmm. the general manager, Harry Albers was selected. And I think you're going to interview Harry?
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
He's next.
Great. Okay. Well, he was a terrific boss. And so he was my boss. And he was very instrumental in helping to... he got me more support for my job, which was really good and was very encouraging. But he also was quite active in getting more property. And when he found there was an opportunity to get the Alvarado Medical Center, he worked really hard to get that. And all of this getting the property was in connection with... trying to help the university so mm-hmm. when the university needed to expand, there would be a place for them to go. So mm-hmm. so another function, a big function of the foundation became obtaining property on behalf of the university.
Okay. At that time, did you have any contact with, or are there other foundations in some of the other state colleges that became universities? Or I was just wondering if there was the communication.
The CSU system. I think there were foundations in all of the campuses. They're called auxiliaries, and there are other auxiliary organizations on the CSU campuses too. The Associated Students is considered as an auxiliary, okay. and Aztec Shops is an auxiliary.
Oh, okay.
And then there are fundraising foundations on too. And the Campanile Foundation is one, so for SDSU. And
okay.
And but we had annual meetings of the auxiliaries, and then there are other campuses around the country that have foundations. It's
right.
not necessarily a common thing, but we had meetings of directors of foundations around
the country. I was wondering
about
that. Yeah.
So I was a member of that University Connected Research Foundation.
Yeah, because I noticed when I was reading your resume that you were involved outside of this context.
Very much. And in terms of other organizations, and we're always collecting information sharing information.
Right.
A lot of the SDSU Foundation was, the research foundation was by far the largest in the CSU system, so people used to come down and ask, what are you doing?
That's great.
So, yes, there were.
That's very good.
I'll
turn it on and you just pick up.
Okay. I was talking about the property and, you know, Harry Albers encouraging that, and I want to say that Steve Bloom was an associate general manager for property. As the foundation grew, we added associate general managers. And Steve Bloom was just very instrumental in all of making all of this work with the property. He was in charge of that. And also in charge of grants and contracts administration for a while until that was handed to me too. So I did want to mention that. And then in terms of what the foundation does, we also provide money and support to the university to help, like, for example, project directors get money back based on some formula for money that they turn in, and then that helps them to develop, you know, they have the seed money to develop new projects. And we've bought research equipment for the campus and given them money for other buildings and just mm-hmm. basically support. And we've been able to do that. And I think, say, Bob Benchoff then became the CFO and managed the money very well. And Davian Gibson was there at the foundation before I was, and she was a special assistant to Bill Erickson, but she really was the heart and soul and made things happen for the foundation. Ended up associate general manager for Harry. And, so those are some key people that foundation and what they do. And then the other thing that we did, and I think this may have started under Harry, I'm not positive, but KPBS came under management of the foundation. So we always handled all their money, but they came under the management. So that was a really interesting thing.
Did you get involved at all in dealing with them?
Oh, yes, right. Yeah. Well, I didn't until I became the CEO, and then I was. And we really had a team working for the foundation of Harry, Daveen, Steve Bloom, Bob Benchoff, and me. So we worked together as we grew all those years. And since we're being interviewed because of John or Jack Adams and Jane, I can say a little bit about that.
I would like that, yes.
I have to call him Jack because I'll forget.
You've solved the mystery. As I said, I read it in your dad's oral history, he kept referring to Jack Adams, and I thought, is that the same person?
Well, Jack and Jane didn't have children, and I think they lived probably pretty modestly. I don't know. It's not my business. But when he was older, he wanted the foundation to manage his funds. And it was getting harder for him to get to the bank and all of that. So he came and he had about $1 million that he wanted the foundation to manage. And so Bob Benchoff said, sure. And he said he wanted to leave it to the foundation for good purposes afterwards. And he wanted it to be things that would help faculty and students in the humanities and arts and humanities. And so Bob managed it for about a year, and we knew that it was going to be, then we want to know what to do with it. So I had suggested that, why not let Jack Adams have some fun with this money before he, because we had collected some interest on it. I think we had $50,000 or something of interest. And I said, why don't we, see what he'd like. And so we solicited little mini grant proposals, and so we had faculty and students that submitted these little mini grant proposals, and for no more than $5,000, and some of them were less, and they were, and so the first year I took the little proposals at Jack's house, and he just had so much fun reading them.
That's great.
And so he picked some, and he might have picked all of them. I know he at the first year, anyway. And so our only requirement then was that after the people got the grants, that all I wanted, it's not like a formal report or anything, I just wanted them to write a letter to Jack to tell him what they'd done. And so we had some wonderful letters from students and faculty, and I think we did that for 2 years. And he had a great sense of humor. He had a twinkle in his eye always, and a great sense of humor. And he was sharp as a tack right up until he died. So then the second year and before he died, in a gentle way, Bob and I thought of a way to say, what would you like to happen when you die? We didn't put it that way, but I mean, he was very much into that. And so he said, I've got my six favorites. And one of his six favorites was this project.
How wonderful.
Because he had always wanted a history of the university, and he loved this. One time he came into the office when he was able to get around better, And he told me, Freya, there's a new librarian who doesn't like books. I've forgotten who the librarian was, but I think it was at the time they were introducing computers and things.
Which is similar to your dad's comments.
Yes, right. He liked the the card the early catalog.
90s.
And, yeah. Yeah. So, but no, he was very, very nice man, and he loved this project. So,
well,
it's really nice.
I'm happy to be sharing as part of it to help this to happen, and it's nice to learn about him because I was wondering who are and what about Jane?
And I never met Jane. She wasn't alive, although she may have. Since he was a friend of my dad's, my first marriage, I know that he was there, and maybe his wife was, but I didn't really. She collected buttons and postcards, and I think he loved her very much. But it was nice. It was a special treat to be given some money because mostly my job it was, finding money we could apply for, and then maybe going and talking to people in Washington or wherever, or about the project, or meeting with collaborators or that type of thing, and asking for money. But here, Jack Adams showed up with $1 million,
that's a great model. Has that been emulated by other professors since?
Well, now there's the Campanile Foundation that handles gifts, and so I'm not aware of any, by the time I left, I'm not aware of anything else. However, that was the June Burnett Institute. I always say my friends Jack and June, because June Burnett left us $1 million. We didn't have to ask. It just turned out in her will she had $1 million to a bequest to San Diego State University. And it was based on an experience that she had had with a man named Mel Murphy, who was a professor at San Diego State at the time. And she wanted to do something that would be helpful to children, youth, and families, and make their life a little better. And so when that $1 million came, my boss, Harry, said, Freya, can you figure out what to do with this? and I thought, oh, good. And at the time, I was in Washington, D.C. for some other purposes, and I wanted to see if I could get a little more money because I wanted to make it an endowment that I didn't want to just, advertise for the $1 million to get spent. And I knew that $50,000 a year probably wouldn't, at that time it was like 5%, it's not right now, but anyway, I was talking to a man in one of the officials in Washington, and Department of Health and Human Services, and I said, and it was back when they wanted to, I think Reagan was in. Anyway, they wanted
in the
to have some. They wanted,
this
yeah,
was,
yeah,
yes.
This was, and they wanted to have some public-private partnerships. So
I totally understand that.
So,
I wrote grants during that time.
Oh, so yeah. So I said, little me, after I finished my other business with them, I said, by the way, I've got $50,000 that we'd really like to partner with to get. And I said, we're forming this institute, and I made the name up, and I said, so is there something that you would like to do with us? And he said, well, why don't you decide what it is you'd like to do, and we'll write up an RFP for it. So they had to publicize it, but we wrote up an RFP. And
this was in Health and Human Services?
Yeah, and it was... it had to do with homeless and runaway youth.
Oh, okay.
And so, when I started looking around, I knew that for the Institute, I had to get some board members, and I had to find out what was an issue. And so it turned out, I talked to, I think, Bill Collender. I talked to several people, and I got a couple community members, and our SDSU Vice President, Al Johnson, and then for sciences and education, I asked for the deans to name two faculty members, and then I had to find Mel Murphy, because Mel Murphy was the one she had mentioned.
Right.
And so I found Mel Murphy up in Northern California, and he was on board. So what ended up happening was we got about $400,000, and we coordinated with a couple of other communities, And it was enough, and they agreed to pay for me to hire a director for the Institute, because I made myself the acting director to start, because, you know, we didn't have it.
Okay.
And so I got this wonderful man, John Wedemeyer, who then became the director of the Institute, and mm-hmm. he formed a board, and we applied for all kinds of projects. That Institute, until it ended, John died, and the university decided that they would prefer to maybe use the money, because it had grown, the funds had grown, because we were getting grants, so we could use some of the grant money, some of the earnings. Mm-hmm. The university decided they would like to use that money for an endowed chair. So that's what they're doing now. But I mean, I left and John died, and it was sad. But mm-hmm. over the period from the mid 80s mm-hmm. until close to 2005 or so, mm-hmm. it brought in about $40 million of grants.
It's marvelous.
And it worked with, you know, local groups and internet. It had a national parent center, and it had a choice program working with Judge Jim Milliken to help kids that are on probation. And there were some wonderful stories. You know, we used to have events that, you know, where kids that had it was like having junior probation officers that in this project, and they would go make sure the kids went to school, and they'd visit the families, and they'd...
Terrific.
And it saved the probation department money, too, and so...
What a wonderful role for a university.
It was really great.
Well, you know, you talk about the mission of the foundation, and I know there's so much conflict, and I'm aware, the East Coast, some of the universities are criticized for not doing things like this.
Oh, really?
We've
done a lot about, I think that's one of the things that San Diego State University does really well. They've really done outreach. I mean, I was all over the country and the world, and make it, you know, collaborations with others, and the faculty are so, I mean, anytime I look for somebody with some kind of expertise, I'd find them, or I'd be amazed at the things that they do. And
well, it sounds, as you said, you're a good matchmaker, too, so you probably were tuned in.
Yeah, for some. I mean, as I say, there are plenty of faculty that know exactly, you know, what they're going to do, and they don't need that mm-hmm. help. They need more of the managing. They need more of the help of managing.
Well, as you said,
the
sciences, but, that whole hard science. Yeah.
But what I really enjoyed seeing was how, when I first started, it was only the College of Education, the College of Sciences.
That's
and
right.
They were the ones that had the grants. And now it's almost every place. I mean, you know. It's,
what a wonderful accomplishment. So I mean, that's great.
So just to see the university grow like that.
It's clear that you innovated and nurtured.
So, well, I guess I'm a mom. I used to call myself the mom of the June Burnett Institute when I talked to the new folks.
But that counts for a lot. I think that's a great skill.
One of our other times where we had our $1 million that we managed to do things with, and there was the Institute for Children, Youth, and Families. There's June and Jack, and then we had Fred. And Fred left some money to promote world peace. You know, it wasn't families, it wasn't humanities, it was world peace. So the executor of his estate came in to see, I guess he went to UCSD, and he only had $100,000, and they kind of said, I don't know. And they came to see Harry, and Harry says, we'll take it.
Okay.
And then there was a man named Bob Untell, faculty member Bob Untell, and Harry got him involved. And he said, well, let's have an institute. we'll have the Fred Hansen Institute for World Peace. And,
okay.
And so with that $100,000, we checked around the world, and I wasn't so involved at the very beginning of this. Bob Antel, I think, went to Israel and Egypt and found there was an agreement to cooperate on agriculture, so that opened the door.
I remember hearing about this.
So, yeah. Oh, good, good. Yeah. Well, what happened
What years was this?
It was around 19... the Camp David agreements were 78, I think,
yeah.
But then it was the 80 or 81 that we had... we brought scientists from Israel, from Egypt, and from the U.S. Agency for International Development, and brought them to San Diego to see, and then a couple of experts from U.S. scientists. So here was a group of around, I don't know, eight or so, and Harry had worked with Bob Antel to put this one together, and it turned out that right when they came, I've forgotten what happened, but Harry did ask me to come and sit with them and write a good old English major, write a proposal, you know, depending on what they wanted to do. And so I went and I wrote the first cooperative arid lands agriculture proposal. And it wasn't all that scientific, but and it was so much fun meeting with them when they were doing the budget, because mm-hmm. of course we didn't have any money yet, but it was we were putting together a $10 million budget.
Wow.
And the Egyptians and Israelis really didn't know each other that well, or, you know, and it was, so we weren't sure what to expect. And instead of it being the Egyptians all wanted this much money and the Israelis wanted this much money, it was mm-hmm. more, okay, the salt tolerant crops group, you know, the American and the Israeli and the Egyptian, that trio, huh. They were fighting for their money.
Yeah.
and so we had, I think, three or four different topics.
Mm-hmm.
But they all got together and fought for their money. And I had to kind of negotiate to make sure it all worked out.
So that must have been fascinating.
It was fascinating. And then what really was fascinating was we did get $5 million that year. And over the next 20 years, we got a lot of money. And we also got to do a national agriculture training program for Egypt, which was 20-some million dollars, and I got to go over there and negotiate that, and that was really fascinating. But over that 20 years, we had a steering committee, so...
And were you working closely with Dr. Day at that time, or with someone he pointed, or how did that work?
Dr. Day, let's see... he would always be there if we mm-hmm. needed him for an event or something, but I don't even remember that he ever went over there. I don't think so. We had trips, our little management team and the steering committee, we had trips. I know a lot about plastic culture because we visited Spain one time, the meeting was in Spain.
Wow.
And we ended up adding Morocco to the group, mm-hmm. which was nice.
Yeah.
And right before it ended, we were ready to add the Palestinian Authority to the group. And it was really interesting. Sometimes there'd be little crises where things weren't going that well between Egypt and Israel, and we had to kind of figure out what to do. We had President Weber went over there, and even before President Weber came on board as president, Shimon Peres in Israel had noticed, he knew what we were doing because the government authorities in both countries knew. And so we had met with him and his office, and he decided to have an Institute for World Peace.
Yeah.
So he... named President Weber at the time, by the time we did it, to be on the board. President Weber must have talked about this.
Yeah, he did.
Because when Harry decided to take a six, right before he resigned, and it was the end of December, he called me and said that he was going to take some time off, and so I would need to go on this trip with President Weber and a couple of congressmen and do the tour of, mm-hmm. of the projects in Egypt and Israel. And
that's exciting.
So we've, you know, done, and I've gotten to know all the people involved in the mm-hmm. program over the years. So, and Al Johnson was on the steering committee too, so he helped, and so we really
really
worked with some great people. And
well, from what I also, it seems like, you know, as you developed, as you went along, you also mentored others and you published. And talk about that a little bit, because I think from what I understand, you were guiding others too. So,
well, I guess so. I mean, when I had staff that were interested in doing a little more, I feel really good about things that I gave them to learn overnight, or, you know, when they wanted to. But then I did workshops and spoke on panels.
Right.
And published the book. That was an interesting thing. I'd been invited to do a workshop in Los Angeles, and I was driving home bumper to bumper and thinking about it, because they had just asked me to give them a written report of everything I'd said during the 8 hours. And I thought, well, I think I could write a book and be first into the market. So, and so I did. I sent a query letter to 4 publishers, and I was a little worried that the first publisher, Plenum, that they had already they had published one book about grants, and I thought, well, this was a different book, but maybe they would give mm-hmm. that idea to their first author. Mm-hmm. But instead, they called and said, "How soon can you have it ready?" And so, and I didn't even bother with the others. So, but that was kind of, I was getting my MBA at the time.
And you did that at San Diego State.
At San Diego State, yeah. So I was doing that, so I thought, well, a couple of my classes I could just offer to write a chapter for my paper, and that worked out. And then I had a colleague, Jean Stein, who was very much a part of the foundation and worked in the development office with me. And mm-hmm. I asked if he'd like to, you know, I had my outline for the workshop, and I said, shall we take turns writing chapters? You know, we'll pick which chapters.
And
that worked out really well. And then it turned out, once the book was published, the woman, Virginia White, was the woman who had written the book that I thought maybe the publishers would give her the idea. Mm-hmm. Well, she decided to resign as editor of Grants Magazine, the Journal of Sponsored Research and other programs. So then they asked Jean and me to, so we co-edited that for 10 years.
Did you have to travel anywhere to meetings for that?
We met with the publisher in New York, and we met with them a couple times in Washington, D.C. when we were there anyway.
Yeah.
It was a nice thing, because it gave us, like, I've talked to lots of different people, inviting them to write articles, and so we could keep up on the latest things happening in our field. I felt really good. We had one author, I asked if he would write Grins in the Grants Office. He thought of the title, Grins in the Grants Office, because you don't want to be too serious about all of this. So, mm-hmm. So that was an interesting thing. So.
Yeah, and certainly helpful to others, it sounds like. Yeah, why don't you put it on again? So tell me more about your work in these different countries.
Oh, I've been so blessed. There were times, like when I first got involved in the Egyptian Israeli project, and especially the very beginning, where I sensed that there was some concern about me, a woman, writing the proposal, being part of the mm-hmm. steering committee, being part of the team. And I think I was lucky, because since this was blessed by the ministry in Egypt, I was accepted. But there was some worry, and there were a couple of comments about, I look different from the other. I think, in fact, when we were first putting the proposal together, somebody mentioned that all the men were in black suits. And when they said that I was the only woman involved, and when they made some comment about I look different, I said, yeah, I was wearing a purple blouse. Over the years, I think I have been lucky, because even when I first got involved in Grant and Con in the proposal development, and then some of the national organizations, they were mostly men that were involved. And I actually did my MBA thesis on career planning for women.
I noticed
grants
that.
And contracts, and really looked at that. So
I think that's very important, and I think that as we began to discuss, you know, it's changed so much over the years. I mean, we had Betty Friedan popping up in between.
Yes.
And it's certainly different now than it was back then.
Oh, it's very different now. I think you might still find that there are more, say, male heads of foundations, or at the national meetings, more men that are deans of graduate or vice presidents of research.
Right.
But women are, I mean, it's way different now, much more female involvement now than there was then. So I did know sometimes there's an advantage to being a woman. I think one of my fun experiences in Egypt was going to visit at the time the prime minister. He had been the minister of agriculture, but because I had worked with him in helping to plan the program, when I went to visit him with my Egyptian colleague, we had a very nice visit, and then he clapped his hands, and seven people came in, and he said, "We want you to go to the Museum of Art." And I walked there. I didn't know what to expect, and they clapped their hands again, and people walked in with seven different sculptures that had been made at the museum, and I was to pick one. And so I have this wonderful sculpture of a man carrying the water, a worker carrying a water bag, so in a way, you do get listened to. I don't know that always happens, and it probably wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had the support of the top people, but was an experience.
It sounds like a wonderful experience. And do you recall, as you were having these experiences, sharing them with your daughters and your family?
Yes, I think we talked about that. And my daughters, I think, and my son, all of them. I think my whole family was very supportive, and I think they enjoyed the hearing about experiences, and also they got to participate in a number of them when it involved people from other cultures, because like I had mentioned, going down to the Peace Corps office and some of the arid land meetings, one of my daughters was able to attend and listen to the talks about plasticulture or whatever it was. And certainly when the Brazilians and Jamaicans were here, we would invite them to our house, and they would tell stories to the kids about, you know, what they were doing. That was when they were younger. So
that's really marvelous. I'll ask if there are any other highlights that come to mind.
Okay.
Tell me about other highlights that come to mind.
Well, one of them is the Defense Conversion Center. And we were able to obtain big grants to help people who had lost their jobs because of their defense jobs. We were able to retrain them. And in that case, it was a little different from the regular grants, because we did get appropriations. We worked with congressional representatives and were able to get the appropriations. And there was such a need for the retraining of people. And it was a nice project, too, because it involved faculty from a number of different disciplines on campus for the retraining efforts. And it went on for quite a while. So we We've trained literally hundreds of people who had lost their jobs to get new jobs that were well-paying jobs. So, and that led to some additional, in fact, there's still some programs going on now that were kind of spin-offs of the Defense Conversion Center. So, but it was different in the sense that we did get appropriations and worked with our congressional representatives.
That's marvelous. That's marvelous. As all of this is going on and it's very exciting, were there particular challenges or obstacles you can that you might want to discuss or not?
I always tend to, I have this memory that looks ahead to the good things and
like
remembers the, and I'm sure there must have been some obstacles along the way, but I think this is a really hard,
it's
a hard question.
Actually, it sounds like from what you described that you had a really wonderful team approach there.
We did.
So that's helpful.
We did. And all of these things weren't easy.
Right.
I mean, they took a lot of work, and, you know, there were, and people don't always agree about everything either. So,
right.
But in terms of thinking of something really specific
that
was a problem.
No, I guess
I mean, kind of obstacles might be, for example, in the Arid Lands Project, when things weren't going so well between Egypt and Israel, we maybe had to postpone a meeting or make it someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Or so, you know, that kind of an obstacle. But I...
It sounds like you had really good team within the foundation, and then also the pretty supportive presidents of the university.
We had a lot of support, and I should mention the Defense Conversion Center that that one of the key people was a part of the team on that was Tim Hushin, and also a part of the team on a key part of the team. On the Arid Lands was Bonnie Stewart, and so we were really fortunate to have good, dedicated people.
Yes,
but that couldn't stop like the outside things, like maybe a grant that we thought we were going to get, we didn't get. Somebody
mm-hmm.
else got it, and we put a lot of work into it.
Sure,
that kind of thing, and we had sort of always budget concerns. Even though we were growing, we were trying so hard to get money back to the university that sometimes it stretched our staff, and then people might say, "Well, we didn't get quite the service we wanted." But mostly, I'd say the faculty were very supportive, and then we had, you know, new people would come in, new administrators on campus, a lot of times they were from universities where there wasn't any foundation, and so you know, the first question was, why is there a foundation?
Yeah.
Can't the university do this?
Yeah.
But in all the cases I can think of, once they understood, they really liked the fact of the foundation and were very supportive. So so I think that. Yeah, those were good things.
Those are good things. Let's ask you about becoming a CEO.
Okay.
Well, then you became a CEO of the foundation. Tell me about that.
Well, I was asked to become the interim CEO when Harry retired. And so I didn't really... I said yes,
uh-huh.
and I continued to do my other job and the interim job, and then about 6 months later, I was asked to become acting because Harry had decided that he had his time off and he was going to go on to do other things, and so